to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, Harold Felder, and today we have a very interesting topic. The topic today is the Nation of Islam. And I have with me to discuss this topic, Stacy Jacobs. And let me tell you a little bit about Stacy. Stacy has a bachelor's degree in accounting. He has a master's of arts in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary. He's pastor at Macedonia Evangelical Church. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I should know. I've been there like half the time you've had service.
Yeah, yeah. And then you go to Southern Evangelical Church.
Exactly. I really should know.
Yeah, you should know.
And the web address for that is mechurch.org.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also a fixture at the National Apologetic Conference. And he's talked about the Nation of Islam on a number of occasions. So without further ado, we're just going to go ahead and just get to it. And I'm going to just come out and ask you, what is the Nation of Islam and how did the Nation of Islam start?
Well, in effect, the Nation of Islam is a black separatist, black nationalist, and I guess I should say formerly black separatist group, since the current leader, Louis Farrakhan, has made ecumenical overtures since the year 2000 for wanting to make it more mainstream and to make it more, I guess, palatable to the rest of America, I guess, middle America, if you will. And it has its roots effectively in the racism, frankly, that was occurring in this country at the earlier part of the 20th century. It started with a gentleman named Wallace D. Fard, who is said to have been an Iraqi national who in the 1930s began a separatist movement, essentially saying that Islam was the original religion of the black man, that black men should rule the earth, that effectively white people were not to be trusted, and they were devils and this type of thing. And so he had a program that was essentially self-empowerment. It was the building of their self-image, self-esteem, if you will. And his message, of course, was popular at that time because, as I stated, racism, bigotry was pretty virulent at that time, and just on the basis of your level of pigmentation, that is, if you were not Caucasian, right, then you were likely to suffer much in this country, right. And so you can understand how his message had taken root in the black community. Now, this was followed up in the 1950s, essentially the 50s through the 60s and into the mid-70s by Elijah Muhammad. Now, he was their first leader for the Nation. Islam proper, and of course many of us are aware some of the more famous adherents of that faith, if you will, which was Malcolm X,
right,
number one, and probably foremost next to Elijah Muhammad. And he followed up with the same sorts of messages that he had learned from Fard. Again, he became probably even more vehement and probably a lot more caustic in his rhetoric against white people in general, and just anyone who was non-black in particular. Now, that's probably not as fair a statement, because he was really directed more towards the white people. There's no way to soften that.
Right,
He was just very hard against them, and typically what he would do was use a reverse psychology of sorts. If you read books like Message to the Black Man, The Science of Time, and stuff like that.
These are books written by?
They were written by Elijah Muhammad.
Okay.
You will see clearly in those books that he takes a lot of the stereotypes that were promulgated and propagated about blacks at that time and reverse them and apply them to white people. So when blacks were called apes and monkeys and having derived from apes and monkeys and this type of thing, he said, you know, white people came from apes and monkeys. You know, black men are actually, you know, the top of the human chain for intellectualism and this type of thing, and spirituality and morality and ethics. So it was really interesting that he did that. And then very quickly, that closed out his era in the mid-70s, and that's when a split came to the Nation of Islam, because Elijah Muhammad's son, who was W. Dean Muhammad, took over for his father, and he wanted to take the nation to orthodoxy, which he did. The American Muslim Society, or the American Muslim Mission, Muslim American Society, has been called a number of things, but that's the organization that he took towards orthodoxy. And Louis Farrakhan rose up at the same time, And he took the group more towards Elijah Muhammad's early teachings, the separatists, the separatism, the nationalism, and the extreme vitriol, I guess, that he spewed against whites and against Jews.
So what is the membership of the Nation of Islam now, do you know?
Well, the numbers vary. I mean, I've seen numbers as low as 20,000, which I don't think is true. And I've seen numbers as high as 2 million, which I don't think is true either. It's probably somewhere in the high hundreds of thousands. And I don't think it would be a risk to say that's like how many Christians are there in the world. I mean, you have people who say that they're Christians, but once you start to test their doctrinal beliefs, they don't necessarily adhere to the fundamentals of the faith. And I would imagine it is much the same for the Nation of Islam.
What about the Orthodox branch? Is that popular?
The Orthodox branch does not enjoy the same amount of popularity and notoriety that, of course, the Nation of Islam does, because it has a very charismatic leader in
right.
Louis Farrakhan.
Right.
So as it is with American society, if it appeals to my sense perception, and it's just a passing fancy, if you will, that piques my curiosity, then I'm likely to matriculate to it. And so that's what the part of the draw is for the Nation of Islam, is that Louis Farrakhan is a very charismatic leader.
You're absolutely right about that. And I remember, you know, watching the movies like Malcolm X and that type of stuff, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and seeing and reading about Malcolm X. And I remember growing up, before I became a Christian, you know, thinking this is so cool,
mm-hmm.
because it
mm-hmm.
did put black people in a good light, as opposed to the light that we were, you know, used to having been portrayed about ourselves. I mean, even in the media. So it was like, it was a sense of pride. And I mean, I guess that's what drew a lot of black people to it.
Correct. And you know, kind of not to get ahead of ourselves, but you're correct. That is a draw that it has. And I can remember the first time that I was made aware of the Nation of Islam, which was through Louis Farrakhan, frankly. I was living in Columbia, South Carolina. I was in college at the University of South Carolina at the time. And one of my friends had told me that he was going to be speaking at Benedict College. And I said, well, I'm not going to go over there because, you know, all I've heard about this guy is that, you know, he hates white people. And it's not because I was necessarily a proponent per se of all things that were Caucasian. I'm not saying that at all, but I'm like, you know, this guy, I'd heard only minor things about him at that point. And so with him saying that, you know, white people were the primary cause of why I was doing stuff wrong, I knew it was ridiculous.
Right,
because I
right.
can name a number of things that I had done, and there was not a white person in sight or who had any influence on that. I'm like, man, this is absurd. You know, I'm not going to that. And I wasn't even saved at that time. I wasn't
right.
a Christian.
Right.
But the time when I really got into some of what the Nation was about, I would say, is through Public Enemy. And the first time I heard something from them was there was their second album, I think, which was titled It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. And there was the first song, Bring the Noise. And it was just a popular thing at the time. Like I said, the same way he's charismatic, that group drew people in
right.
through charisma. And because it was a new sound and everything, much like Run DMC was when they came out. And I heard my cousin playing it on his booming system in his car. And I heard that one line, Farrakhan's a prophet, and I think you ought to listen to what he can say to you. What you ought to do is follow for now. And I said, hey, man, rewind that. Tapes, not CDs. Tapes.
Yeah, yeah.
Tape.
You still want an 8-track?
No,
I'm just messing with you.
So then, nevertheless, I asked him to rewind that, and again, I started listening to some of the stuff they had to say. So they opened up my eyes that there was a world that was larger than just my sphere of influence. And then they were speaking directly to issues, you know, that were in my life. Again, my sphere of influence, my sphere of living at that time. And so they were like a voice that I heard coming out that I'd never heard before, saying the things that they were saying.
Right, right.
So it was very appealing, but it didn't win me over because I understood the absurdity of white people made me do it.
Okay, so let's get down to what they believe. What are their core beliefs?
Well, in their core beliefs, in effect, and I've touched on some of them at sort of a high level already, is that one of the main things that people latch on to, I'd say more than anything, is that they have expressed in times past through their official doctrine, their official pronouncements, if you will, and through their own public speaking and public rhetoric, an extreme hate. I don't think that's a mischaracterization. I think an extreme hate for people of Caucasian descent, people of Jewish descent. They also have, in terms of their theology, It would appear that they're monotheistic because they always talk about Allah, as we would understand that name to have come from Orthodox Islam. But if you examine their doctrine just a little bit more, and some of their writings just a little bit more, they appear to be more polytheistic because some of the actual things that they promote. Again, if you look at Message from the Black Man, one of the most famous writings that has come from them, God is Allah, and he created these scientists, you know, who themselves were going to manage and help the rest of the universe develop and evolve. And these scientists had a certain number of years that they would live. I can't remember the exact number, maybe 25,000 years that each one lived. And so they themselves were called gods. So now you have God Allah, creator God, I would imagine, and you have these little gods up under him. So that is polytheism, because right. there are many gods, not right. just one, poly meaning many. But given that there's this creator God and these other little gods under him, that would point to henotheism, which would be like a hierarchical structure of gods. Creator God, and then these this rotating shift of scientists or little gods that create and manage the universe after that. So that's differs significantly
yes.
From the monotheistic religions of Orthodox Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. In regard to Jesus, they have the view of him, as many non-Christian religions have, that the historical Jesus in fact existed, and he was a great prophet, and he was a good man. And Louis Farrakhan went so far as to say in a speech he gave, I think it was in 1999, maybe 2000, but nevertheless, he says, you know, yeah, we believe in Jesus, and we believe that you ought to live like he lived. And so they sort of give Jesus his props, if you will. But he's not God incarnate. He's not God the Son. And in fact, he's a lesser prophet than Muhammad. So that follows a line of a lot of other cultic or cult doctrine that you would hear about Jesus, or definition, if you will, about salvation. You know, we believe that you're saved by grace through faith. It is the gift of God, not of works, that no man should boast, not of ourselves and this type of thing, because of the sacrifice that Jesus made. Well, salvation for them is sort of multi-pronged, but in effect it is to have atonement, at-one-ment is how they define it, the word atonement, at-one-ment, by going to those people that you have wronged, and you make up for the wrong that you've done, and you, I guess, give reparations, if you will, sort of a remuneratory justice, I guess you could say, remunerate, to repay them, and then you start to do right after that. Now, that's pretty strange, because it has nothing to do with personal sin. It has nothing to do with an ultimate standard for justice or righteousness. It actually points back to the self, like most cults do. It points back to the self for your own empowerment to free yourself from whatever has you bound in regard to salvation. It's a strange thing that you could warrant favor with God, with Creator God, through works.
Now, can white people be saved?
Well, you would think that in an objective sense that they could, but if you read from that definition of atonement, but now if you read enough of their material, you will see that the disdain for white folks goes so deep that at some point it seems like they're just they're irretrievably lost,
okay,
irreconcilably separated from God,
okay.
So it would appear, but that's a good philosophical question, I guess, if we were witnessing, you know, can, based on your definition of atonement, you know, can Caucasians be saved?
Right.
Given that they're devils created right. by Yaqub, the evil scientist right. on the island of Patmos, my goodness.
Right.
In regard to the Bible, like many other cults, they believe that the Bible contains the Word of God. They don't believe that it is the Word of God. They believe that in its original form, which they never describe what that is, In its original form, it was the Word of God, but it's been tampered with now down through the ages, especially the King James Version.
We've heard this before.
Yes, we have. I mean, when you think about the Mormons.
Every religion says that.
That's right, the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yes.
I mean, you can continue to name them, that again, the Bible has been tampered with down through the ages, which no one is ever able to prove.
Right, I mean, but if they're going to try to get some credibility,
correct.
And if what they say go against the Bible, then they must say that the Bible itself is incorrect.
Correct, and it's a good hook. Again, it's something that piques the curiosity of those with itching ears.
Right.
And so, which makes it kind of strange that the Bible has been tampered with, and it can't be trusted, yet I know for a certainty that Elijah Muhammad has quoted from the scriptures, from the Holy Bible. So has Louis Farrakhan, does it a lot, especially when he's in the black churches, whenever they let him in there. That's amazing that happens.
Yeah, okay.
But when they allow him to stand behind the sacred desk, he gets his chance to read from the Bible. Now, if it's been tampered with, then how do you know which parts have been tampered with and which parts are true?
Right.
And if part of it is true and you can't tell which part is true, then apparently none of it is worth trusting. You should throw it all out, especially
right.
if you have the truth that has come down from the only prophet,
right.
Muhammad.
Right.
We've talked about white people. They don't have too much of a problem with Christianity other than to say it keeps people bound. It keeps you bound in ignorance because you can't resurrect from the ignorance of your mind and awaken to knowledge of self. So I've given Public Enemy some props, but I got to give them a few knocks upside their head too, because in one of their works titled Apocalypse 91. That's when I got saved in 92, so I don't know anything they did after 92. But it was in Apocalypse 91, The Enemy Strikes Black. They had a song called Shut 'Em Down, and it says, before Shut 'Em Down, there was a little intro, and it says, on one corner is the church, and across the street is a liquor store, both of them keeping us poor, keeping us down. My hood it ain't considered a town. And I wasn't saved, but I was like, now, you can't be talking about the church. You know,
right,
it's just something
right.
that didn't seem right about that and didn't ring true about what they were saying. And that is not true, that the church is keeping us down. The church is liberating people, liberating us from the bondage of sin. And the church is actually what sustained black people through the times
right.
of slavery up until today. And so I can't imagine that any black person would be able to deny that history
yeah.
and say that even though the scriptures were used deceptively and oppressively and deceitfully by the slave owners at that time and by others whose minds were blinded by the ruler of this age, which is the devil. Nevertheless, it was still a great tool of liberation because it contains the truth of God. And wherever the truth of God penetrates the darkness of falsity and lies,
yeah.
you know, then the light of revelation of God is going to come through that illumination.
Because we've had, we had the abolitionists mm-hmm. who were actually really followers of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Bible that was actually used as a foundation to do away with slavery.
Yes.
When it was used correctly.
Yes, and that was the foundation for the moral and ethical appeal
right.
That allowed it to come to pass. So.
Right.
Again, they don't have a particular problem with Christianity, and you know, if he did, if the Nation of Islam did, and if their leader, current leader Louis Farrakhan did, I don't think that he would traipse and cavort through these churches the way that he does, with such apparent ease.
How does he view himself, Farrakhan?
How does Farrakhan view himself?
Yes.
Now that's an interesting question that's sort of tangential to what we're talking about tonight, but it's difficult, I think, or near impossible to separate the Nation of Islam from Louis Farrakhan. I don't think that you can separate the two in this day and time. So today, literally, he views himself as the only person appointed by God to, in his own words, bring together the three branches of Abraham. Which are the three monotheistic religions of Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, because he says that the three of them have their roots in Abraham, so he believes he's been divinely appointed in this day and time to bring them together under that umbrella.
Right. Because I heard him give a speech one time, and man, it sounded to me like he was coming real close to calling himself the Messiah.
Well, I know that I have heard him say that he is Messiah. I've heard him say that.
It wasn't just me.
I have a recording of that at home, and my ears almost fell off when I heard that because I was thinking, man, that is that's beyond blasphemy. And not only that, but it contradicts your own stated doctrine, which is on their site right now. Their official statements and propagations talk about, here it is, what we believe. What we believe, and this is from the Muslim program that is on their site today, okay? From the Muslim program, what we believe, and this is point number 12, which reads, "We believe that Allah, God, appeared in the person of Master W. Fard Muhammad, July 1930, the long-awaited Messiah of the Christians and the Mahdi of the Muslims." So at the very least, he's in contradiction to their own doctrine, which says that Fard is Messiah. So now if Fard is Messiah, then he can't be Messiah, or else he's saying that I and Fard are one, which he clearly is not saying that, because he still says that Fard was the one who taught his teacher. And his teacher, in fact, is going to be the Messiah, because he's going to come on the mother plane.
Right.
Where he, and that's their eschatology.
Now, yes, please tell me about that.
That's their eschatology, where Elijah Muhammad will come on the mother plane.
Explain which is what the mother plane is.
The mother plane is, in effect, what we would call a spaceship. It's a spaceship that has been created by the scientists, so that in the day, in that great judgment day, what we would call Armageddon, in which Christ will actually defeat the forces of evil and death and hell and everything at that time. No, Armageddon for them is when Elijah Muhammad comes back on the mother plane, this big spaceship that has more weapons than this world has ever seen, enough to, when it shoots this beam out, it can drive up mountains upon the face of the earth, you know, affecting the tectonic plates and the earth's crust and this type of thing. And it's going to destroy all of the Caucasians. It's going to destroy them, in which case the blacks will then be left to rule the world. Now, this raises an interesting question about the blacks ruling the world, because what happens to the browns, the yellows, and the reds, and essentially all of the non-Caucasians, and the blacks themselves are on top? That's something that we'll have to have some more investigation from and words from them. But again, it points to such an absurdity, and it's just a reversal, frankly, of white racism.
It raises some very interesting questions, because myself, and I'm not alone in this. I have, you know, part of my family were slave owners and part of my family were slaves, because you had the slave master who, you know, slept with the slaves. And so we, to a degree, most of us are, you know, not purely black or African, as you would say. We are all a mixture. So I don't know how that would work.
And that's an interesting thing too. It's very convenient that the white people were created by Yaqub, that they were grafted from the life germ, and the evil scientists created them at Patmos, because then they don't have their origin per se in the black man, which, if you think about it, that's even contradictory, because if the life germ is the source for all life, including black men, then no matter how it was manipulated by this evil scientist, the very genesis of their creation, being that the progenitor was a scientist, still came from that life germ that Allah created. So even that defeats itself. But it's convenient that they haven't thought about it that far, but that they've taken the white person away and made him to be something less than black, so that his destruction couldn't be considered anything that's anything to worry about, anything that's ethically grievous. If you look at my complexion, again, you know that I'm not derived from the straight Nubian princes and that type of thing. I mean, my maternal grandmother, her name was Queen Elizabeth Jones, and there was a movie several years ago that Halle Berry starred in, her and the young lady that played Whitley in that TV show, whatever that was.
Yeah, I know you're talking about.
But nevertheless, Jasmine Guy. Yeah. But the title of that movie was Queen, and that was a great example in microcosm of what it was like for my grandmother, because you can't tell her or my mother, Vivian Valentine, apart from white people in general, literally. You can't tell them apart. I mean, my father was about three shades darker than you are. And so I'm like, so what would happen to me? And that's a good question. What would happen to you?
Right.
Is the destructive ray that smart and that well calibrated right. that it'll kill all of the white in us
right.
and then only what's pure will be left. Those types of philosophical questions haven't been posed to them, I'm certain, and I don't think they would have good answers for them.
Right.
It's absurd to even mention such things.
Right. So do you consider them, or are they considered a cult in the classic sense?
I think in the classic sense of the term, if you got very, very technical, maybe they wouldn't be. If I look at what Walter Martin has to say about a cult, how he defines it in his book, Kingdom of the Cults, on page 17, he says, by the term cult, I mean nothing derogatory to any group so classified. A cult, as I define it, is any religious group which differs significantly in one or more respects as to belief or practice from those religious groups which are regarded as the normative expressions of religion in our total culture. So if that's the case, they would probably be considered a cult of Islam,
yeah,
but not
yeah.
so much of Christianity, okay. because they're not making claims to be Christianity. They're just being syncretistic in their approach and pulling in different elements of Christianity. So
right.
I would say that they're cultic
right.
as it relates to our faith,
right.
but certainly they'd be considered a cult
for the Islamic
for Orthodox Islam.
And that's what a lot of people don't realize. When we talk about a cult, when we talk about cults, they're cults for every major religion, because it's basically mm-hmm. a offshoot of a major religion that denies one or two of the, or some of the major tenets. Like Jehovah's Witnesses is a Christian cult,
mm-hmm.
and the Nation of Islam is a Muslim cult. So how does the Muslim faith in general, the religion, view the Nation of Islam?
Well, they're not viewed very well in the eyes of Orthodoxy. Not until recently, when the Nation of Islam in February of 2000 at the Savior's Day speech that Louis Farrakhan gave then, he and W. Dean Muhammad reconciled at that time, and Louis Farrakhan said that he would bring the Nation of Islam under Orthodoxy at that time, in which case the Orthodox Islam that W.D. Muhammad is over enjoys great favor with Orthodoxy in this country and abroad, because they do adhere to the fundamentals. But we'll have to see how that plays out in the time to come. But in times past, they were viewed very negatively and as a reproach to Orthodox Islam because of the things that they promoted.
Well, we're running out of time, but I do have one question, maybe I can sneak in two here. Objections, you know, because people are going to say, well, the Nation of Islam has done great things for the black community. I know in D.C. where they had this really bad project, and mm-hmm. they came in and basically cleaned it up.
Mm-hmm.
So since they've made so many positive contributions, then why bother them? I mean,
that's the idea of pragmatism. You know, if it works,
yeah.
then it's right. And we understand that pragmatism is not necessarily moral or ethical, neither does it serve as a basis for truth. If that's the case, it was practical and it worked that slaves were under the whips of slave masters out there baling that cotton and baling that hay, and it worked out well for the slave owners.
Right.
It didn't work out well at all for the slaves.
Right.
For the thing, I mean, they did the same thing in Chicago with the Cabrini-Green, a notorious project full of drugs and crime and violence and so on. But some of the means that they employ to do those things aren't altruistic. I mean, in a suburb in Detroit, Eric Pement, I believe you've heard of his name before, he's an expert on the Nation of Islam as well. And when he did an article on the Nation of Islam, and he interviewed this pastor in Detroit, the pastor said that the Nation of Islam came in the neighborhood where his church was, and they beat up the drug dealers. You know, they beat up the gang folks, drove out the prostitutes, and they never came back. And so they didn't have any more problems. So after that, the churches have been praying for years, this guy says, and nothing ever happened, and witnessing for years, but nothing ever happened. But they came in and essentially unlawfully engaged in vigilantism
right.
and cleaned up the neighborhood. And besides that, it's been shown that some of the things they do, some of the areas that they clean up, when they leave, revert back to what they were. So there's
right.
no lasting change or lasting impact
right.
that occurs. I mean, we could go in with force and do the same things against the law
right.
and get some of the same quick results, but that don't mean they right. would last.
Thanks. This is going to bring us to the close of the show. I thank you a lot for being on the show. That will conclude this episode of Giving an Answer. Now, I want to say, if you have any questions about the show, about Christianity, about how you can better defend your faith, call me. Email me. If you're just watching the show, I mean, let me know so I know that you're out there watching the show. But until next week, goodbye and God bless.